Al-Haq and Sahar Francis, director of Ademir. We will have links to both of your organizations and some of the recent investigations that you're involved in, and the commission, of course, up on the Electronic Intifada.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Art Talk Bus Stop, the monthly youth-centered podcast about how artists do their work and make a living. This month, April 2022, we are repeating a couple of episodes from our archive while we prepare to work with a new group of students at McDaniel High School. We hope you'll enjoy these two short episodes from our archive featuring Renee Sills and Jody Darby. We'll be back again on May 25th with a brand new episode. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Art Talk Bus Stop. I'm Emily from ROCA, which is Reynolds Gallery of Contemporary Art, and I have my other students with me, which are...
Hi, I'm Sophia.
Hi, I'm Juan.
Hi, I'm Esmeralda.
And we have Erica, our producer.
Hi.
And then we have our guest, Renee Sills.
Hello.
I guess I'll start with one of my questions. What is SOLA School, and like, what does it mean, or what do you do?
SOLA School is the name of a program that I started and that's actually also ended. So it ran for about 5 years. It was the School of Living Arts. And this was a program that would train teachers to do adaptive and inclusive movements with people. And so we had a loose structure that followed a yoga teacher training program, but the stuff that we were teaching wasn't so much yoga like you might think about it, like certain poses. It was more the function of bodies and how your physiology worked when you were moving. And then we had a lot of practices that were focused on inclusive practices, and that means that we could meet people where they were, in what setting they were in, what clothes that they were wearing, and what their bodies needed. So we would train people to kind of understand anatomy and physiology and functional movement and injuries and different kinds of conditions that someone might experience in their body, like age or disability or pregnancy, but also things like race that could be a prohibiting factor in someone enjoying themselves or feeling comfortable in a yoga studio. So it would be important for a teacher or facilitator to understand like racialized trauma that someone might carry in their body as well. So SOLA School was a program that lasted for 5 years, and actually in 2018 it was our last year, and it has dissolved now, but it's still going because it still functions as a volunteer program. So some of our students have taken it over and are now running like a volunteer kind of outreach program, and they work with other movement trainings, yoga teacher trainings, Pilates trainings, dance trainings, stuff like that. And then they bring in a module on inclusive practices and adaptability. And then they place teachers in a variety of locations. So there are teachers at elementary schools, at high schools, at senior centers. We work with an outreach center for women and children who have left abusive domestic violence situations. We've worked with incarcerated people. So that program is still going on, and I advise with it now. I'm kind of like on a board of advisors and work with the students that have taken it over, but it's no longer my project.
Mm. Okay. So what are you currently working on since that has expired?
So currently I have my own art practice, which is very personal for me. Maybe I'll do things with it in the outer world, but I have my own art practice, and I work professionally as an astrologer. I have a project called Embodied Astrology, where I blend my interest in body work and movement and somatics with astrology. And I produce a podcast. That podcast has been going on for about 6 years. And I work with clients. I read their charts and talk to them about their lives. And then along with the podcast, I put out horoscopes. They're audio format, so kind of a podcast format as well, and some guided meditations and things like that. So that takes up a good chunk of my time.
Mm. Why did you get into astrology?
That's a great question. Well, I was exposed to it early on because my mom really liked astrology. She got into it in her 20s. And she practiced it kind of on an amateur level, but she would talk to me a lot about it. And she used it a lot when she was raising me. Like, I would misbehave or be, you know, moody about something. And then she would be like, oh, it's because you're this. You know, it's because your moon is this. So I learned about my chart pretty early on. And then when I was in my early 20s, I was in a relationship, a romantic relationship that was incredibly confusing and upsetting to me. So I started reading a book on astrology called Relating that's like about relationships in astrology, and it made so much sense to me and it was immediately applicable. And so I got obsessed and I just started reading about it. I spent about 5 years just studying, like reading as much as I could, kind of learning how to read charts. And then in 2012 or 2013, that's when I started actually reading people's charts and been kind of moving from there, becoming more professional or whatever I am.
Yeah. Do you make your money reading charts, or like how do you make your money, I guess?
I have various income streams, so I make my money definitely reading people's charts. I don't... I get tired doing that a lot, so I can't take enough clients to make as much as I need. So I also, in the last year, have started working with a podcasting host that offers sponsorships called Anchor FM. And that's started to bring in some money to support the podcast as well. And then about a year and a half ago, I started a subscription with my astrology work, and people can sign up by donation. So it's a sliding scale, pay what you can. And in exchange for their donation, they get access to an extended month ahead forecast and like a printable astro journal that I make every month, and discounts. Mm-hmm. So that's actually really started to sustain my work this year, just in the last couple of months. The podcast sponsorships and the subscription have started to work for me as an income stream. So that feels really exciting. It's the first time in my life that I feel like I've really had stable income. Mm-hmm. And I'll be 37 this year, so I feel like I've, you know, finally become a grown-up, which was taking a long time before with my artist sensibilities. So.
What was your experience like in high school?
I really hated school. I dropped out, actually, in seventh grade. Mm-hmm. I left and unschooled. I don't know if... Are you guys familiar with unschooling?
No.
The basic theory of unschooling is that people are smart, and they will learn if you give them the right conditions, and they don't need you to tell them what to be interested in, at what time, for how long. What they say is that if you leave like traditional school, then you need to take a year to decompress and deprogram. So that's what I did. I spent my eighth grade year like lying around on the floor and not doing much at all. And then I got really motivated to do creative stuff. So I spent most of my high school experience kind of designing creative-based projects. I did some theater projects and some traveling projects and some writing. And I worked with a correspondence program in Michigan that accredited me. So I was able to like send in my self-directed study stuff. They gave me a container for it. Like, I had to figure out how to do social studies and science and math and English, etc. But then I was able to actually get a high school diploma. But I did a self-directed course.
Oh, do you have like any bad job or like bad job stories?
I worked in retail for one day. My friend worked at this shop that had like really nice clothes, and I thought I would like to work there because I'd get discounts on the clothes. But I really didn't do a good job at it. It wasn't a good match for me. So I don't even think I finished out my day or like told anybody that I was leaving. I think I literally just left and never went back. So that was a kind of a bummer.
What do you enjoy most about your work or like life?
I enjoy a lot of things about my work and my life. I really enjoy being my own boss and setting my own schedule and doing something that I find interesting and that I care about. I also think that astrology is really helpful. A lot of people have ideas about it that it's like a fortune-telling kind of thing, like, oh, you know, some witchy person is gonna tell you all about yourself. But I actually think that it is much more like a very sophisticated and nuanced personality assessment, kind of like Myers-Briggs or something like that. And that it really helps people accept themselves and understand what their natural talents and gifts are, as well as where they run into problems in their personality, because we all have problems in our personality, right? And sticking points and struggles. And astrology is just a really generous and kind language to think objectively about yourself and your tendencies. And so my experience working with people reading their charts is that it's a lot like therapy. Like, people will cry, they'll like have really important kind of emotional breakthroughs and be able to accept themselves and like see themselves, but also love themselves more and forgive themselves for things. And that feels really important to me. I care a lot about people, and I want to, you know, do good in the world, and it feels important that I spend time doing something that helps people. So that's also what I really love about my job and how I spend my time.
What's your favorite star sign or like constellation?
Oh, my favorite sign. Well, I don't know if I have a favorite sign, because I think they're all really great, but I do have a favorite season. So astrology, you know, all the sun signs like Cancer, Virgo, Pisces, they're descriptions of seasons and light, the kind of light that we have. So I would say that my favorite season is like Taurus and Gemini season, like late spring getting into early summer, and that like when the earth is like exploding, you know, like everything is blooming and light is getting really cool and there are like baby animals everywhere, is one of my favorite times of year.
Something about like OMSI, like, right, you have a place like in OMSI, or you did?
Yeah, I was the artist in resident at OMSI, the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry, for 2 years, and that was a position I made for myself. I don't know if they still have an artist in resident. I just kind of asked if I could be that person. They said yes. So I spent 2 years there, mostly hanging out in the museum and watching how people were interacting with the space and how they were learning. OMSI has like a really great program for experiential learning with science. And then I did a couple of different projects there, but the one that I worked on the most was called Movement in the Museum. And that project involved pairing science educators from OMSI with movement educators that I curated from the outside world. So I brought in dancers and yoga teachers and other kinds of movement artists. And we would have classes, and the first half an hour of the class, one of the science educators would be introducing some kind of topic. So like how light and sound waves work, or how weather patterns work, or we had one that we looked at bugs and their exoskeletons. And then a movement artist would respond to the science educator and teach a movement class to embody some of the principles that the science educator was teaching us about. So that was really fun. I'm a a kinesthetic learner. I learn a lot through my body, and it was really fun to play around with different scientific principles through movement.
Yeah. So do you have anyone that, like, inspires you, that, like, helped you become who you are today?
Yeah. So many people are inspiring to me. Let's see. Right off the top of my head, two of my biggest inspirations are both performing artists. And I'm thinking about Grace Jones and Laurie Anderson. I don't know if you know who either of them are. Grace Jones is a musician and a model and a performance artist. And she was, or they were, like, the first person where I really felt inspired by androgyny and, like, a gender non-binary and kind of a revolt against, like, I don't know, Western beauty standards. And the way that Grace carries themselves is has been really inspiring to me, just in terms of, like, a social presence. And Laurie Anderson is kind of similar. She is also a performing artist, but she and a musician, but she's also an educator. Like, her performances are really intellectual and in-depth, and she uses a lot of new media and electronics. She has people make different kinds of machines for her that she uses. And her performances are often really political, or they're very educational in nature. So I was really, still I'm really inspired by her work. Yeah, those are the two people that come to my mind first.
I have a question. We have had a couple of guests already, and one of those guests was Ryan Pierce, who does a lot of work about ecology, but in a totally different way than you do work, his oil painting. And so I wondered if you would say a little bit about your connection with the natural world and how that inspires your art, wow, or you as an artist.
Yeah, thanks. I love that question. I feel really connected to the natural world and also really disconnected from it. I grew up in the Rocky Mountains and spent a lot of time outside, and was always, like, camping as a kid, and have a really strong connection to the land that I grew up on. But then also, like you guys maybe, I've grown up also in cities and using technology a lot, and especially now, you know, I'm, like, attached to my phone and I work on the internet, and so it feels harder and harder to access nature. And the situation with the environment is getting worse and worse in the world. So it feels really important to me to try and keep connecting with nature, and to do what I can to help other people remember to connect with nature and to love nature and to take care of it. So I do that definitely through astrology and through body practices. I think just getting in touch with our bodies is, like, a really good way to remember that we are nature. And a lot of times we forget because we live in our automobiles and in buildings and in clothes and with all of our devices. But it's pretty quick for most people when they just take some time to connect with their bodies to feel how disembodied our lifestyles are, and how much I think most people crave fresh air and slowing down and natural light and the sounds of birds and bees and trees and things like that. And I definitely talk a lot about the environment in the podcast that I produce, and try and encourage people to care about it.
Can you just say a little bit more about what you mean with, for yourself, what does it mean to be in touch with your body?
Yeah. That's a really big question. I feel really out of touch with my body a lot of the time, just because of all the things I said. Like, I'm using public transportation or in my car or on my phone. That's really a big thing, like being in the digital realm. And so getting in touch with my body could definitely include physical things like dancing or taking a walk or doing yoga. But more than that, it's actually just, like, trying to feel my body from an inside perspective. So, like, can I feel my feet? Can I feel that I actually have feet? Like, I live in a body. I'm not just a brain. What happens if I, like, notice how I'm breathing? And most of the time, when I take the time to notice how I'm breathing, I notice that I'm not really breathing. especially if I've been doing the things that I do with my life, like looking at the phone or working on the computer or being in transit. And that, like, really simple just checking in with my body is also checking in with the pace of nature. And I notice that as soon as I can, like, slow down and breathe, that the fast pace of human life and urban life around me kind of gets a little quieter, and I might notice something like a cloud passing or the temperature of the air or something like that. So, right, like, our bodies are nature, and if we want to connect with nature, it's pretty easy just to, you know, look down or breathe in.
So, like, how do you advertise your work?
How do I advertise my work? I use social media, mostly. Having a podcast is its own advertisement because it goes out on multiple streams and it shows up. You know, when people do a search for astrology podcasts, mine will come up. So that's nice that it's just built in. But I definitely use Instagram. That's kind of the main place where I promote my work, and I have that automatic function to post directly to Facebook after Instagram. I don't quite have the bandwidth for Twitter, but I have an account, but I never really use it. So yeah, that's the main way, is through social media. And I have business cards, you know, sometimes I'll leave them around, but it's also a lot of word of mouth at this point too.
What do you do in your free time?
In my free time, I really like to read. I like to be in my body. So I love to hike, and I love to take movement classes of all kinds. I love to learn. So I'm always on the lookout for a class or a workshop or someone who wants to hang out with me and teach me about something. I just, in the last year or so, picked up a drawing practice again. I used to really like drawing as a teen, so I've started drawing and doing some creative writing. And then I, like, have the rest of my life, which takes up the rest of my time. I have a significant other, and, you know, we spend time together and do stuff together and have a home to care for and friends that I want to see and things like that.
My voice. I can't.
Do you have any funny stories at all, like, about life or anything?
Yeah, you might need to give me some more direction, though, to point me in
just
what,
like,
kind of funny story.
Maybe about astrology or...
Yeah.
Oh. Or, like, any embarrassing story.
Oh, an embarrassing story. I am sure I have many of them. I often feel embarrassed right after I put a podcast out because I go through a blank and I don't know what I said. Mm-hmm. And so my mind attacks me and it's like, you said all these horrible things, or nothing you said made sense. And I usually feel deeply embarrassed for about 48 hours after something goes out. Sometimes I make mistakes, like, that are really obvious typos, or I say the wrong thing. And then people who follow astrology, they're like, you said that wrong. And then I feel embarrassed. I can think of one embarrassing, really embarrassing thing that happened, but it was when I was teaching yoga. So this was, like, maybe 12 years ago or something. I was showing people how to practice doing a handstand, and we were practicing walking our feet up the wall. So, like, you would be standing on your hands, but your belly would be facing the wall and your feet would be on the wall. And I taught this really early morning class. It started, I think, at 6:30 or 7, and I was pretty tired that day. And I thought I could do this kind of jump thing that would get me out of it, but then I landed on my face. And then I was so confused about why that had happened, because I was like, that shouldn't have happened. So then I was like, no, I did that wrong. Let me do it right. And then I did it again a second time. I landed on my face. Oh, that one took me a while to get over.
Yeah, that's a pretty good one.
You talked to me earlier about both your parents were artists, right?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of art were, like, they into? Like, or did they do?
Yeah. So both my parents were definitely artists. My dad had he went to college for art, but then he went on to become a teacher, not of art, of political science. But he still is an amazing craftsperson. He was a painter when he was in college. He did a lot of like abstract figurative work, kind of, I would say, in the vein of Salvador Dali, like really weird, kind of trippy stuff. And then now he is a wood carver, so he makes a lot of wood sculptures. But he's also been a creative mechanic. He built out a school bus into a tiny house, kind of, but this was in the early 80s, and that's where I grew up, actually, was in the school bus. And my mom, I don't know if she would have called herself an artist, but she loved to be creative. So she was always drawing or sewing or making something, and she really loved to dance, and she loved the arts.
What kind of dancing would she do?
She would take off her shoes and twirl around and like close her eyes and sway a lot, and she always had a big smile on her face. So it wasn't a style of dancing. She loved to go out dancing, and when I was about, I guess I was about 7 or 8, she met a woman who teaches a form of dance called Five Rhythms, and that's not a choreography dance. It's like no steps, but it's kind of working with different rhythm patterns. And she took classes with that woman and became close friends with her. My mom actually died when I was 17, and that woman ended up becoming my legal guardian for the last year of before I was a legal adult. So that type of dance has been around in my life for a long time. But again, it's not any set dance moves. It's just kind of like letting yourself dance, but in different rhythm patterns.
Renee, do you have any questions for the students?
Yes, I do. I think art is really important in the world, and I think maybe creative thinking is incredibly important in the world right now. So my question for you all is, how do you intend to be artists in your lives, no matter what it is that you do when you grow up?
Well, I'm always, you know, drawing like on my homework and stuff like that. And I always think of like, oh, what two things can I combine together and like make something out of that? Or we do drawing games sometimes when we go visit middle schools and like advertise what we have here to take, and we'll like fold a piece of paper in half and like have one person draw a torso up and have another person draw the waist down and see what we can do. And I just I just like I said, I like drawing, so I'd probably continue that throughout my whole life. It doesn't matter what I do.
Great.
Yeah, I think I will always do art in some sort of way. I don't do a lot of art now, but I do want to get more into it. But, like, art makes me happy, and I feel like it's always, like, a nice thing to do, and I probably will always do it.
Art for me has always been like a passion I've had, and so like it's something I want to like dive into like a career wise, like specifically like art therapy is something I've always been interested in like working with kids or like adults, things like that.
Nice.
Cool. For me personally, I'm always going to keep art as kind of a thing to do, just because you kind of think about it everywhere, and for me, I'm always going to be sketching something or writing something. So I guess that's my way of keeping it relevant with me.
Cool. I love the way that artists think, like the ability to put two things together or to look at something and sketch it or think about something artistically is such an important life skill. So I hope you guys keep thinking of yourselves as artists, no matter what other people call you. Just always call yourself an artist inside, at least.
Yeah.
Do you guys want to give the podcast listeners any information about ROCA upcoming events?
Yes, so ROCA has this big annual fundraiser. It's where we gala artists from the school or like school district, and we sell it in one night. It's gonna be at 5 o'clock on March 5th. It has lots of like crazy cool student art. Registration is February 25th. That's when you drop off the artwork, and you drop it off at Reynolds High School.
And Renee, do you have any, do you want to give us ways to find you and more information about your work online for listeners of the podcast?
Yeah, people can go to embodiedastrology.com, E-M-B-O-D-I-E-D, astrology. And I put out free horoscopes every month, and they are available on iTunes and Spotify and Stitcher and all the other podcast apps.
Great, thanks.
Thanks for inviting me to be here.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming.
Welcome to Art Talk Bus Stop, a monthly interview series with Portland area artists about how they do their work and make a living. I'm Nicole, a freshman at PCC.
And I'm Erica Thomas, producer of the show. We are co-hosting remotely, and we're excited to welcome our guest, Jody Darby. Jody is a media artist, activist, and educator, specializing in experimental video and photography. Her projects deal with rebellion and joy, and her work seeks to amplify stories that often go unheard while pushing back at the narratives of dominant culture. Jody, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for inviting me.
We had talked early on, Nicole and I, about just asking you to describe your work in your own words. How do you describe your work to young artists or non-artists?
Well, you know, it's taken me a minute to get to a place where I can actually talk about my work, because I feel like I am constantly experimenting and constantly sort of trying new things and dropping them and picking them up again. And I think that the thing that I've kind of landed on and stuck with for the longest amount of time is kind of reappropriating moving images. I love taking still photos. I love photography. In terms of using a film camera or a digital camera to tell stories, it's not my thing. I'm not really excited about like creating a storyboard and shooting all these scenes over and over again. Or it's just, I've learned that the thing that really excites me is taking stuff that people have already shot, right? Taking, you know, old films, taking people's home movies and taking them apart and adding things together that don't belong there, or changing a narrative from a story, like completely changing the end by editing some different things in there, changing history, making history turn out the way I want it to turn out instead of the way it actually turned out. You know, I mean, it's kind of a little bit of playing God, but you know, it's fun. My work is definitely using moving images, reappropriating them, changing them through an editing process, and doing that from a place, I think, of intuition. Mostly when I sit down in front of a computer to edit, I don't know what I'm going to do until I start doing it most of the time. Unless it's like a commission work and someone says, you got to do it this way, I kind of just sit there and like, I kind of like trance out. I kind of just like let it kind of overtake me for editing. I mean, people think editing is such a like boring, linear, nerdy thing. And it is sometimes, but it can also be like an opportunity to like channel some heavy stuff too.
Yeah, there's definitely like a rhythmic thing with editing. The trance thing is something that's relatable to me as a former editor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, also, like, your whole body goes numb because you're not moving it, which is weird, you know, which is not ideal. But especially working with home movies as raw material, like, it's like going through people's underwear drawers. Like, it's, you know, like, you really get your hands on some stuff.
Well, you mentioned sort of taking stuff that isn't necessarily personal to you and recreating it in a way that you want to. How do you go about doing that? And how did you first, what first drew you to doing that?
I mean, I've always loved film, and I've always loved the way film looks. Just like the process of celluloid against light, like just blows my mind every time, you know, I can't get enough of it. I realize that I I don't get that feeling when I look at video. Like, I like stuff. I mean, there's definitely people who shoot video that make it beautiful, and it's nice to look at, especially on a big screen. But in terms of just, like, there's, like, a feeling that I get when I see film. And I wanted to, like, live in that world. I wanted to, like, sit in that world and, like, have that feeling all the time. So I started playing around with this archive that a guy named Rick Prelinger, he created a thing called the Prelinger Archive, where there are all these, basically anything you would want to look at movie image-wise on film is in this archive. And he uploaded them so that people could borrow them, take them, and use them for things. So it's royalty-free moving image archive. And there's all kinds of stuff on there. And I spent a lot of time looking, beginning to, like, look through the archive just to kind of be like, who are we? What is the material of our existence? What are the things that people felt like they needed to capture? Like, what were the things that are the most, is it like your kid's birthday party? Or is it like what are, and then how do different people handle their Super 8 cameras in the 50s? Like, just, there's just a million questions that watching those things kind of like answer and turn me on. So then I started kind of, after looking at those, I started playing around with them. I think, you know, probably the first piece that I did using borrowed footage wasn't even about like anything emotional. It was me trying to figure out how to edit action, because I recognized that all the work that I had done in terms of editing was like documentary with like a head talking at you, and then it would cut to like some other thing, and there was like never any action that I was trying to edit. And I wanted to get good at editing something a little more dynamic visually. And so I just downloaded a whole bunch of like clips of dude movies, you know, like these action movies of like men running and jumping and shooting each other and beating each other up, just to see how I could put them together. And I made a movie called Man Movie, sort of playing around with this idea of like the dramaturgy of action movies and the things that men do with their body over and over again in these movies. And so I edited all those together, and I was like, man, this is fun. I'm gonna do this all the time now. So I'd be like, oh, I want a scene of somebody getting a chair over their head in a bar, right? And so then I would be like, okay, Roadhouse, somebody gets hit with a chair in Roadhouse, I remember that. And I would just think about all the movies where somebody got a chair to the head, and then I would try to find that scene and put them all together. So you just be like, ching, ching, over and over and over and over, and it's, you know, I enjoy that sort of thing, I guess.
Just to kind of like get a timeline of when this was in your life, was this before or after college, or was this like in your adolescence, or
no, this is now, man.
Oh,
that's funny. No, I didn't do, I mean, when I was an adolescent, there was like no such thing as any of this, right? Like, there weren't computers. I went to college for film. I mean, I went to college for media studies, which looks very different than your experience with media studies, right? Like, mm-hmm. I did probably a lot of the same things that you do, but instead of Photoshop for graphic design, we would do what's called paste up. And we would do it all on paper. And we would have what were called rapidograph pens that we would draw with. We had Lectraset letters, which were these like sheets of, you would get, go like to the art supply store, and there'd be one of those like swivel things, like, you know, greeting cards were on or whatever. And it would be like Helvetica. And you would like buy a pack of Helvetica Lectraset letters, and you would rub them off with a quarter to transfer the letters onto your design, right? And then if you wanted a picture, you would take the picture with your camera with the film in it, and then you would take it to the dark room and you would develop it. You know, I mean, it was just like tactile, and it was like these like processes, arduous processes. So then after I graduated from college, like 1992, then everything went digital, which was wild. And then I became an instant dinosaur because I didn't know how to do any of that stuff. And so I spent years denying that this digital thing would even catch on. Like, I was so upset with all the like craft that I had learned, right? Like everything that I learned to do, and I love doing it. I love physically being in the dark room and smelling those chemicals that were rotting my brain out. And like, I loved using my hands, right? I loved doing that process. And then I was just like, you cannot tell me that if I want to do this work for the rest of my life, I have to stare at a screen. Like, that is not my karma. That is not my reality. I'm not going to do it. And so I like waited tables and I bartended and I did all kinds of stuff for years before I learned how to do digital work. I mean, years. I was a grown up. I was in my like late 20s before I like started figuring out how to like do digital art again.
Did you end up ever like actually taking any classes, or did you just become self-taught?
I went to PNCA. This was back in the Pleistocene. When was it? Let's see. I moved to Portland in 1996. I think I took the class maybe 1998 at PNCA, and it was a Photoshop class, and I hated it. I hated every second of it, and I was awful at it. Like, I was just like, what is this? The only thing that I liked about it was that the processes in Photoshop were named after the processes in actual graphic design that I was, you know, there's like the burn tool, the dodge tool, you know, like there were things that I could like truck with because I'd done it in the dark room. And I was like, oh, that's cool. They're actually like borrowing the language and they're using the language of the actual, you know, what I considered like the right way of doing it. I didn't take any other classes after that. And I just taught myself. Like, I just sat down and figured it out.
Nicole, you are curious about, I mean, Jody mentioned moving to Portland in, what'd you say, 1996?
I think so.
Ish.
Well, I think the people should know. You grew up on the East Coast, correct?
Correct. Yeah, right outside of Washington, D.C.
So when you made that move to Portland, what drew you to coming over here? Because I know from like looking at some of your work, you've been kind of all over the U.S. and a little bit of out of the country. So what made you kind of get up and station yourself here?
I wanted to get as far away from my family as I possibly could. I actually, when I graduated from college, I went to college in Virginia, and the day after I graduated, I got in my car with my friend Kelly Cobb, and we drove cross country, and she left me in San Francisco. And I lived in San Francisco for a minute. It wasn't my thing, but while I was there, I took a couple trips to Portland, and I loved it. There was something about, I was like, this place is disgusting. I love it. Like, it was like, it was like run down and like gritty. And it's funny because I realized after I moved here that it wasn't really as run down and gritty as I thought it was. It was just my friends that I was hanging out with took me to all the like rundown, gritty places. They gave me the tour of like all the like grossest bars in Portland and the shadiest places. But I liked it, and I had friends here already, and they were going to the Northwest Film Center, and they were in bands, and they were making movies, and it just seemed like a great place to connect and be an artist.
I see. So, kind of focusing on Portland, one of your works from 5 years ago now is called Arresting Power, Resisting Police Violence in Portland, Oregon. So, I'm going to be really honest with you. I thought you were really quick to make this, and I thought you made it around with, like, everything going on in 2020. But then I went to go watch it, and it was made in 2015. And at that time, I was maybe 12, 13. So I didn't know much about what was happening in the world. And I know this project, as Erica was telling me, it took some time for you to make. When did you start the whole like process of this, and when did you start filming everything, getting the interviews?
Yeah, well, thank you. That's a compliment. We worked on that film for 5 years. It started out, Julie Perini had moved to Portland and had lived here for a couple years and was involved in activism. She reached out to myself and Aaron Yankee to collaborate on something. We weren't really sure what, but she wanted to do something that was about policing in Portland. This was also around the time that like Portlandia was just taking off, and so we kind of wanted to talk about how like Portland is not like that. She reached out to us because we had a show together, Aaron and I, on KBOO called Circle A Radio for about 10 years. And it was an anarcha-feminist public affairs show. And Julie knew that we knew a lot of people who were involved in activism. Like, we knew their phone numbers. And so she was like, hey, can we work together? And so out of that collaboration came the first iteration of Arresting Power, which was called Safe and Sound. And it was an installation. And it was basically, it was talking to folks who had negative experiences with police, whether it was they had family members who were killed by cops, or they themselves had had experiences with police here in Portland. And the installation was at Place Gallery. There used to be a gallery upstairs in Pioneer Place Mall, which is wild. A guy, Gabe Flores, used to run that. A lot of people came to that, and a lot of people were interested in it. And we recognized that there was a desire to learn more. Like, people were like, what, this is all news to me. So then we decided we were going to do something larger, and we wanted to include stories of resistance as well, because that's an important part of the story. And so that is the point at which we started, doing more research, doing more interviews, finding people to talk to, sort of deciding if we were going to just, talk about, like, folks of color, people with mental health issues, like how we were going to frame it. And so that was, I would say, I couldn't even tell you, a few years. It took us between 4 and 5 years to finish. So it started out as a very different project.
What specifically was your role in this film?
It was a collective effort, which is like, this is not the way movies get made, right? Like, but we decided that we wanted to make a movie where we all shared skills and we all took turns doing all of the things. So, for example, my role was a cinematographer. Like, I ran the cameras. It was interviewer. It was researcher. I edited. I did titling. We went and got, music supervision, and we all did those things, and we taught each other, which was wild, because I don't think I'll ever do that again, but it was an incredible experience, right? And it was like, we were a three-headed entity, we weren't a monster. I was going to say we were a three-headed monster. We weren't monsters, but we had three heads. Like, I feel like I didn't, go to the bathroom during that five-year period without calling Aaron and Julie and being like, hey, I think I'm going to go to the bathroom. Like, everything we did, we, ran by each other. Like, as far as the movie, everything that we did. So if I was editing, I would edit for a day, and then I would send that cut to them, and they would give me feedback, and then I would go make the changes. It was just constant feedback or we were just in the same room together all the time working on it. There was like no separation of roles. And I don't know of any movie that's happened that way, you know, like a feature length film. I don't know, maybe that's a research project.
Yeah, I feel like I can sort of relate to like the how things aren't normally made like that, but I feel like anything that I do is sort of like that. It's normally not made like that, and I just make it way more harder on myself than it should be. But sort of going off of that, I believe it was you, or it could have been either you, Julie, or Aaron. In an interview, you guys talked about how it was a lot more than you guys realized it was going to be. As if you'd gone on a date with someone who you had a crush on, and you ended up pregnant at the end of it. So going from there, if you could go back to the film and do anything differently, even if it was just one thing or maybe the entire thing, how would you go about remaking the film?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. Nobody's ever asked that question before. I don't know if it's the best answer, but we had a thing happen where we decided we wanted to use this archival footage that we got from the Oregon Historical Society. They have a moving image archive. It's like out in the east side. And we went there to look to see what they had in terms of like civil rights marches and like, well, all the stuff that's now in the movie. And we saw it and we were like, oh my God, we have to have all of this. I mean, this is gonna make the movie poignant and feel, you know, real. And then we learned that that stuff cost $12 a second. I know, I made that same face, Erica. And so we're like, well, we can't do that. I mean, we didn't have any money, right? And so, but we saw it. We couldn't unsee it. We had to have it, right? And so we got underwritten by KBOO. So we got the nonprofit deal of $6 a second. And we did a Kickstarter. Then kind of soon after we did that and the film was made, Matt Cowan, who runs the Moving Image Archive for the Oregon Historical Society, told us that they decided that that footage, all the footage there should be free. And so now it was. Doing that Kickstarter was so panic-inducing. I will never do another Kickstarter again. I feel like it took years off of all of our lives. And I think if I could do something different, I would have talked Matt Cowan into giving us that footage for free and not doing a Kickstarter.
Sort of going on to the topic of like grants and residencies, can you kind of talk about the process of receiving either a grant or a residency?
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible as somebody who's like making things and putting them out in the world to receive something like that. It's like, it's not just like, oh, wow, I can do this project because I have the funding for it, but it's also like, oh, you see me, or you see the worth or the value in this project. And it really does mean a lot. Because sometimes it can feel like you're making stuff in a vacuum and like nobody cares but you. So, you know, I feel like, you know, getting accepted to a residency or getting, you know, having a grant accepted it's not just about the thing itself. It's about like feeling recognized and appreciated.
As of right now, it's kind of hard to create things and be collaborative. How do you think you're either going to work on your own things during this time or sort of afterwards, the aftermath of this pandemic? How do you think your work would translate to?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I just did a big project with my partner, who is a flower farmer and a ceramicist. She works in porcelain. And we collaborated on a project that was called Portal. And it's one project in a larger kind of constellation of things that we're going to do together. We intend to like keep collaborating and keep doing work. And it's the work that we did and that we want to continue doing is landscape based. So it's site-specific installation work in a landscape outside. And so we were able to do that because, I mean, we lived together, so we could hang out. And then, you know, she's working outside in these plots, planting. And then people came and they, you know, they came to the closing. The work that we did was, it's not up on my website yet because it just happened, but I created videos that were memorials for people who were killed by police, and we put them in the locations of the murders. And originally what we wanted to do was create kind of like goggles, kind of like, you know what a ViewMaster is? Usually they're red and they're these little like plastic toys that you like put a circular little cartridge in, and then you can like do this and the cartridge moves and you see different images going around. We wanted to make those. We wanted to make goggles. Mariana was going to make them out of porcelain and then put them around the city. And there would be, she would build a slot in the back so that you could slide your cell phone in. And so there would be, you'd go to this place, there would be these goggles, there'd be a QR code, right? You click on the QR code and the video starts. You put it in the goggles and you look in, and it transports you to this portal of remembering the person whose life was taken in this spot. That was the original idea. And then COVID came and we were like, people aren't gonna wanna put their faces on stuff. So we had to change that. So we still made the videos. There were still memorials. There was a huge plot of marigolds that she was tending throughout this whole process that she was growing on a site in Kenton, in the Kenton neighborhood. And those flowers were kind of the mother site for all of the different memorials. We would harvest those marigolds and take them to the different sites all over the city. So that just happened. And then I just finished making a video for this guy, Chris Funk. He's a local musician. He's in a band called the Decemberists. He also does solo stuff, and he just put out a new record, and he asked me if I would do a music video for him. So I did. And it's gonna, I don't know, be released sometime soon. I don't know when at all. But so I'm still kind of chucking along with stuff. I think I would get really depressed if I wasn't doing something, right? But yes, I much prefer working with other people. I don't know, it's like expansive. There's an expansiveness to it that you're like, you're not just making art and then that's it. Like you're forming relationships that are long lasting, or, you know, ideally.
I have one last question. We all like to ask all of our guests, do you have any advice for emerging, aspiring artists or creative people?
Don't listen to them. Just do what you want to do. Listen to yourself. Experiment. Try a lot of different things on. And don't try to be perfect. It's funny because if we had a friend that always told us, like, oh, you're awful, that's terrible, like, we wouldn't hang out with them, right? So, like, why would we do that to ourselves? Don't do that. Just believe in yourself and just keep playing around.
Excellent advice. I think that's a kind of a common theme too. A lot of people are like, just keep making stuff. It's not going to be great until it is. Just keep making it.
Yeah. Yeah. And then one day you'll wake up and it'll be like the coolest thing ever.
Cool. Thanks for being here with us, Jody. It was really great. I've been wanting to invite you on the show since we started. So I'm super glad
you.
We got a chance to talk with you.
Yeah, it's really nice to have you on here.
Thank you so much. And best of luck to you.
This has been a rebroadcast of two archival episodes of Art Talk Bus Stop. Our show airs the fourth Wednesday of every month. Tune in May 25th for a brand new episode.
on 90.7 FM.
Tune in Thursdays from 6 to 7 p.m. to hear Rose City Native Radio with your host, Jackie Malmstrom. Rose City Native Radio is a new public affairs program bringing you local and national Native issues and Native contemporary music. You can find more information about the show online at kboo.fm or find us on Facebook at Rose City Native Radio.
Good afternoon, lovers of jazz. Welcome to a new edition of Jazz Lives, coming to you locally at 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm. I am Marcia Hawker, your host until 2 o'clock, and we are continuing with our special program for Jazz Appreciation Month. In my first hour, Dan Davey, director